Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Matthew Ho, Senior Fellow with the Center for International Policy, who assesses rising tensions after a Houthi rebel drone attack on Saudi Arabian oil fields, which many fear could lead to a destabilizing regional war. Amanda Skinner, President and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, who explains why her group is no longer participating in the federal Title X healthcare program and what that decision means for their patients. And 14-year-old climate activist Alexandra Villaseñor, who talks about the importance of the September 20th global climate strike and the urgent campaign to move the world to action on climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the days leading up to Israel's parliamentary election scheduled for September 17th, the Joint List, a coalition of Arab political parties, was poised to play the role of kingmaker. The Joint List coalition was ready to join a center-left majority coalition government in order to oust right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Because of a high degree of mistrust on both sides, the idea of an Arab-Jewish coalition government has been taboo over the 71 years of Israel's existence. Among the conditions for joining a coalition government, the Joint List called for the repeal of the divisive nation-state law, which defines Israel as a Jewish state. Historically, Palestinians have boycotted elections since it bestowed legitimacy on Israel's occupation of their land. Many Arabs residing in Israel live in deep poverty and have become increasingly open to forming local political alliances with Jewish parties to secure funds to improve education and healthcare. Pragmatism also moved some Palestinians to support mainstream opposition candidate for Prime Minister Benny Gantz, a former army chief of staff. In the final days of the campaign, Netanyahu called for the annexation of the Jordan Valley, home to 800,000 Palestinians and constituting 30% of the land in the West Bank. According to some political analysts, Netanyahu's proposed annexation, a blatant violation of international law, is likely to have increased turnout among Arab-Israeli voters in the election. While Republican Senator Rick Scott was governor of Florida, his administration effectively blocked $70 million in federal funds available to fight the state's HIV epidemic, according to a new investigation by the Guardian newspaper. Coupled with the fact that Scott refused to expand Medicaid in Florida, this new revelation helps explain why the state's tragic increase in HIV cases was unique across the U.S. during Scott's tenure in office. From 2015 to 2017, Florida was forced to return $54 million in unspent grants for combating HIV to the federal government, due to an apparently deliberate failure on the part of state health officials to secure legislative authority to spend these desperately needed funds. In 2015, Scott's administration directly blocked two U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention grant applications that would probably have secured $16 million for Miami and Broward counties, which have some of the highest HIV diagnosis rates in the U.S. In the 5 years prior to 2013, the number of HIV cases were in decline, but increased by 11% through 2017, the very same period of time when the state of Florida declined tens of millions of dollars in federal AIDS funds. Marlene LaLota, a 28-year veteran of the Florida Department of Health, who was the administrator of its HIV-AIDS section from 2014 to 2016, thinks Rick Scott fueled the epidemic in Florida and asked how many infections could have been prevented with that money, how many lives could have been saved. During Republican Chris Christie's reign as New Jersey governor, the state had some of the most lucrative business tax breaks in the U.S. The law establishing these incentives, the Economic Opportunity Act, expired on July 1st. In August, New Jersey's incumbent Democratic governor, Phil Murphy, conditionally vetoed $11 billion in new business incentives and called on state legislators to act on sweeping reforms of tax incentives he proposed in late 2018. The American Prospect reports that reformers have been encouraged by the ceasefire negotiated between development officials in Kansas and Missouri. The two states share a border and a single labor market and have had a notorious business rivalry. The recent truce ends the state's efforts to lure businesses and jobs across state lines by offering tax breaks for corporations based on the number of jobs created. Tax reform advocates say that virtually no jobs are created in this system, and instead, the tax base is eroded as a small number of companies game the system. Now, five New Jersey state legislators have called for a similar interstate truce for the New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania labor market that would end the tri-state competition for jobs that depends on increasingly generous tax breaks to steer new businesses to one particular state. Opponents of corporate tax incentives say that these tax breaks are only a tertiary concern for companies deciding where to move. They say the ability to move goods and services and the educational level of the local workforce are more important. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Following a drone attack on Saudi Arabia's oil production installations on September 14th, tensions have soared in the Middle East, stoking fear that a fuse has been lit on a regional war. Houthi rebels, operating out of neighboring Yemen, took credit for launching the drone attack, which crippled more than half of the Saudis' oil output, 5% of the world's oil supply. President Trump's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo quickly accused Iran of being responsible for the attack, but provided no evidence to support the charge, which was strongly denied by the Iranian government. Officials in Tehran say that the allegations are being used to justify a future attack. Mr. Trump initially announced to the world that the U.S. was locked and loaded to respond to the attack, but later appeared to step back from imminent U.S. military action that would almost certainly disrupt world oil supplies. Since 2015, Yemen's Houthi rebels have been engaged in a deadly war with Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who receive logistics and weapons support from the U.S. The conflict has killed between 50 and 100,000 people and is considered by the UN to be the most dire humanitarian crisis in the world today. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, who in 2009 resigned his position with the State Department in Afghanistan in protest of the escalation of the Afghan war by the Obama administration. Here he discusses the attack on the Saudi oil fields and the dangerous consequences of a regional war.
It's very dangerous what we're seeing right now. Whether or not the Iranians are involved, I doubt they were. The Houthis have been launching all types of drone attacks for the last couple of years into Saudi Arabia. They have technology from different places. They do receive some support from Iran, but to say that the Iranians were behind this attack is really, I don't believe there's really going to be any evidence of that. But it's very, very dangerous what we're staring into right now in a sense of, I mean, the entire region, Scott, is already awash in violence and chaos. I mean, from Libya all the way east to Pakistan, literally every nation there has been touched by incredibly destructive warfare, then at least horrible terror attacks. You know, even in Iran, they have suffered multiple terror attacks over the last 20, 30 years that have claimed the lives of as many as 10,000 people total. So it's something that's not really talked about too much. But what we're looking at now with the possibility of major war between, say, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the U.S. against Iran is something that is really disconcerting and very, very troubling.
Is there an opportunity with this escalation of tension between the United States, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Iran? Is there an opportunity to orchestrate some talks here to end the war in Yemen and reduce the tensions all over that region?
You know, I would certainly hope so. You know, it's curious that this attack occurs, the timing of it. because there was had been conversation last week about President Trump possibly meeting with either the foreign minister of Iran or the president of Iran in order to try and maybe hammer out some new agreement. That would be, of course, something that will be really startling to see based upon so much of the Saudi and the Israeli positions towards Iran and the way that the U.S. government is often so beholden to those two nations. But President Trump is a president unlike any we've ever had before, and there have been people saying that he's very interested in receiving a Nobel Prize, Nobel Peace Prize. But it's really quite remarkable for all that we put into understanding organizations and all that we put into understanding international affairs, world events, that it comes down very often to the whims of just one or two or three people control the destinies of so many.
Military planners at the Pentagon have long warned against a wider war with Iran, comparing it with the U.S. war in Iraq and saying the conflagration that the United States would be involved in a war with Iran would be magnitudes larger and more dangerous if the United States were to engage in a conflict with Iran.
It's not the war the Pentagon wants for a variety of different reasons. There are certainly some within the Pentagon that do want the war, but if you look at how the services, the different armed services structure themselves, the Army is more interested in Russia right now because they like to have their tank divisions and their cavalry regiments in Europe to fight the great land battle. God help us if that ever happens. The Navy and the Air Force are more interested, of course, in confrontation with China because that requires long-range bombers, that requires aircraft carriers and submarines, the big-ticket items. And Iran doesn't really do any of that. Under a conflict with Iran, in terms of the first stages of the conflict, I think would be overwhelmingly decided by the United States in because our technology and our firepower is so much greater than the Iranians. The Iranians have some what are called asymmetric capabilities, so they may be able to, you know, sink an aircraft carrier or so. But quite frankly, the conflict would be very much overwhelmingly in the favor of the United States in the opening phases. But then after that, what occurs? What do you do? Do you invade Iran? Do you repeat the Iraq war again? I mean, that's absolutely insane. So it's not the conflict that many in the Pentagon want. You know, God help us, because some in the Pentagon do want it and others want conflict with Russia or conflict with China. But it is something that's very concerning, and everybody who's listening and everyone who has the ability needs to speak out against it.
That was Matthew Ho, Senior Fellow with the Center for International Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on the dangerous escalation of tensions between Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Planned Parenthood has been the largest single provider of federal Title X funded services, serving about 40% of the 4 million patients who receive the government program services, or about 1.5 million patients. Those services include all manner of health care, not just reproductive health. Planned Parenthood's Title X services provides affordable birth control and reproductive health care for women and also for men, and has been the go-to place for compassionate care for many who couldn't afford health care otherwise. Planned Parenthood has been the target of Republicans and right-wing anti-abortion religious groups for decades. But now, under the Trump administration, attacks have escalated. On July 15th, a final federal rule went into effect, making it impossible for the organization to continue receiving Title X funding, causing Planned Parenthood to leave the program in mid-August. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Amanda Skinner, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, which serves the states of Connecticut and Rhode Island. Here she talks about why the organization is no longer participating in Title X and what that decision means for their patients.
The Title X program is the nation's only national family planning program. This is a program that has enjoyed bipartisan support for all of its existence, which is approximately 50 years. It's just good public health policy to ensure that all people have access to comprehensive family planning services. And this program is particularly focused on ensuring that low-income people, people who don't have insurance and also have low incomes, are able to access basic comprehensive family planning services. So this includes birth control, cancer screenings, and sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment. Those are all services that are covered by the Title X program, or ostensibly have been since its inception. This administration has done a number of challenging things with this program. They have radically changed the program from a program under the Obama administration where participants were required by the program to provide access to truly comprehensive services, including having to provide access to all of the evidence-based methods of contraception. That is no longer the case in the way the Title X program is currently designed, and that was changed under the Trump-Pence administration. But the other issue is this gag rule that has been finalized and is now being enforced, which is a rule that requires that organizations that participate in the Title X program, one, are not able to provide abortion services, and two, and really sort of devastatingly and shockingly, are not able to even refer patients for abortion services, including patients who ask specifically for a referral for those services. It's really no different than restricting a healthcare provider from referring a patient for diabetes care or cancer care when the patient needs that referral. And yet this gag rule actually prohibits that for organizations that are participating in this program as it relates to abortion services. I would not characterize what Planned Parenthood did as opting out of Title X. I would characterize it as being forced out of Title X. We had no option. This gag rule was requiring us to gag our healthcare providers and to expect our healthcare providers to mislead their patients or to lie to their patients, which we simply will not do. We believe it is unethical and immoral. I think that's very consistent with any expectation of medical ethics, and we just simply weren't going to do it. And I think what is particularly devastating is that in many communities, Planned Parenthood is actually the only provider of affordable reproductive health care, the only provider who really provides comprehensive reproductive health care services. And so for Planned Parenthood to be forced out of this program means a direct reduction in access to care for the people who are served by the Title X program.
What impact have you seen so far?
We're just starting to see the impact really happen. At Planned Parenthood of Southern New England, we are absolutely committed that our doors stay open and that we will not turn anybody away based on their ability to pay. In our communities, in the communities we serve, we have provided 88% of the Title X care. That's just too many people for other healthcare providers to absorb. And so our commitment to our patients is to ensure that our doors are staying open. That being said, not every community is like Connecticut or Rhode Island. And just yesterday, it was announced that Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio is closing two of their health centers in Cincinnati. And I think we're going to see that there are thousands of patients who are losing access to care.
How could this be turned around?
Well, in the immediate term, we are looking to Congress at the moment to attempt to address the issue with the Title X program. As I mentioned, this is a program that has had bipartisan support for decades. So there's no reason that it should not continue to have bipartisan support. There's no reason that this should become a partisan issue, actually. And we saw that the House committee that is chaired by Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro acted very quickly to put forth a budget that would have protected the Title X program from the implementation of this gag rule. And so we are now looking to the Senate to say, you know, the Senate needs to take action.
That was Amanda Skinner, president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of Southern New England. Find links to Planned Parenthood's website and articles related to the groups being forced to end their participation in Title X by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Alexandria Villaseñor has spent her Friday morning since December 2018 taking the New York City subway to United Nations headquarters, where she stands alone in front of the 39-story building with signs that alert passersby about her mission, calling for international action to address climate change. Alexandria, now 14 years old, was inspired to launch her UN vigil by 15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who, beginning in August 2018, skipped school on Fridays to stand in front of the Swedish parliament to demand her government seriously address climate change. Her action moved thousands of students across Europe, and later the U.S., to participate in the Fridays for Future movement that's demanding governments around the world aggressively address the growing threat of climate change. After several international Fridays for Future protests over the past year, young people and adults from around the world will join together in a massive coordinated strike on Friday, September 20th, to protest government and business inaction on climate change. The protest, just 3 days before the start of the United Nations Climate Action Summit, is predicted to be one of the largest environmental demonstrations in world history. A second international Earth strike is planned for September 27th. Your reporter spoke with Alexandria Villaseñor, a co-founder of U.S. Youth Climate Strike and founder of Earth Uprising. Here she talks about the importance of the September 20th global climate strike and the urgent campaign she's helping to organize to move the world to action on climate change.
In September, on the 20th, there is going to be a global youth-led climate strike, and it is sending a message to the world leaders who are flying to New York City for the United Nations Climate Summit that we are demanding them to make change at this summit. And through that, there's going to be a week-long actions, and then ending with an adult-led strike on the September 27th. And so really through this, we are sending a message to the whole world that we are demanding change and our world leaders need to act now on the climate crisis.
What's the main message that you want people listening here to take away from this particular event that you're helping organize right now on September 20th? What's the importance of it?
You know, my message for everyone on here today is that we really need everyone onto the streets demanding bold climate action because we have no time to waste and we need everyone out there protesting for our futures. And it's my generation who will be affected the most by the climate crisis. And we can't vote. And so going out and protesting is one of the only ways and one of the best ways to get our voices heard. And so we need everyone, youth, out on the streets.
Are you hopeful that this particular action coming up on September 20th will change the hearts and minds of the politicians that have been paralyzed in not taking action on climate change?
You know what? They're going to have to because there will be so many students out there demanding action that there will be no way to ignore us.
What gives you hope that there will be the kinds of change that you're demanding, given the fact that, as you know, the fossil fuel companies provide hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions to the politicians who, for the most part, are the climate change deniers in our House and Senate. And all over this country, you've got elected officials who, very bluntly, have been bought and paid for by the fossil fuel industry. What gives you hope that you can overcome the power of their money?
You know, what really gives me hope is that the youth movement is it's growing every day and it's getting larger and more students are getting involved. And, you know, OPEC recently said how the youth movement is the number one threat to the oil industry. And I think that's what really gives me hope is that the youth movement is changing the conversation. And since we're growing, we're going to get out there and make change.
Alexandra, I wanted to ask you a bit about the kinds of conversations you have about the motivation of some of these politicians who certainly have children, have grandchildren, and if they don't have kids or grandkids themselves, they certainly have family members who do. And the kinds of thought process you think goes into their climate change denial, which has really frozen our country in place and many other countries around the world into inaction on climate change, when it comes to the welfare of their direct family members and the next generation, it just seems counterintuitive that they would
not take action to protect future generations.
Yeah, it is. It's really upsetting that a lot of politicians and people in power are choosing profit over our future. And it shouldn't be the responsibility of my generation to make sure that they look past money and they actually look at our future and what is how we have to preserve this planet that we have. And there's also a lot of politicians, the people who are donating to them are fossil fuel industries. And so they are listening to their donors.
And you're hopeful, as you've said, you're hopeful that continuing action and agitation by the youth, whose generation really has the most at stake here, and everybody else, all the adults here who live in this world, will help change their views. What do you think it's going to take in terms of protests or occupation-style mass sit-ins or civil disobedience? Have you given thought to some next steps? Because it seems like simple protest, at least to date, has not done the trick, that maybe things need to escalate in a nonviolent way. Have you any ideas on where we go next?
Yeah, you know, the movement, it's just going to continue to grow. And I think we really have to look at past movements like the 18 days of protests in Egypt to bring down President Mubarak. We really need to escalate our actions and do things more direct action because that long. We need protests that last through days and days till our demands are met.
That was Alexandria Villaseñor, a co-founder of U.S. Youth Climate Strike and founder of Earth Uprising. Learn more about the youth movement organizing worldwide actions to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.